are more apt to say they're hopeful and motivated about this idea of a possible rematch. Biden's voters, and a lot of voters, more apt to say that they're nervous, even frustrated about it.
According to the poll, President Biden trails Trump by 3 points. While thousands of people are still weaving through the streets of the Big Apple running the New York City Marathon right now, the elite runners have already crossed the finish line. For the men, the winner was Ethiopia's Tamarit Tola on ABC.
Here comes Tamarit Tola, and all that exhaustion will give way to elation as he wins the 52nd running of the
He finished a record 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 58 seconds. The women's marathon came down to a three-person sprint, and Helen Obiri of Kenya was able to pull away from the pack, winning for the women. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credit.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Explosions and gunfire early this morning in Gaza. Israeli warplanes struck two refugee camps, killing dozens. The strikes came as U.S. Secretary of State Blinken visited the Middle East today and met with the Palestinian president, who called for an immediate ceasefire. CBS's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem.
It was Secretary Blinken's first trip to the West Bank since war between Israel and Hamas began almost a month ago. The U.S. State Department spokesman said Blinken told Abbas that Palestinians in Gaza must not be forcibly displaced. He said they also discussed the need to stop extremist violence against the Palestinians, referring to the rising number of attacks by Jewish settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank.
The U.S. is pushing for a humanitarian pause to get aid to desperate civilians. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on CNN's State of the Union.
We have got to stop the bombing now. You had over 600,000 people pushed out of their homes. Where are they going? They're saying in United Nations facilities, overcrowded. There's not enough water. There's not enough food. There's not enough medicine.
But Israel said it will press on with its offensive to completely destroy Hamas. The clock is ticking again for another potential government shutdown. Funding is set to run out November 17th. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson told Fox News Sunday he's optimistic.
I think you see a united and energized House Republican conference. All of our members are working together in good faith, trying to solve these great challenges that we face. And I'm very optimistic.
A possible Biden-Trump rematch in 2024 has Americans reacting. CBS News released a new poll today. Director of Elections and Surveys Anthony Salvanto told Face the Nation.
Donald Trump's voters are more apt to say they're hopeful and motivated about this idea of a possible rematch. Biden's voters, and a lot of voters, more apt to say that they're nervous, even frustrated about it.
According to the poll, President Biden trails Trump by 3 points. While thousands of people are still weaving through the streets of the Big Apple running the New York City Marathon right now, the elite runners have already crossed the finish line. For the men, the winner was Ethiopia's Tamarit Tola on ABC.
Here comes Tamarit Tola, and all that exhaustion will give way to elation as he wins the 52nd running of the
He finished a record 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 58 seconds. The women's marathon came down to a three-person sprint, and Helen Obiri of Kenya was able to pull away from the pack, winning for the women. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
This is the story.
Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Explosions and gunfire early this morning in Gaza. Israeli warplanes struck two refugee camps, killing dozens. The strikes came as U.S. Secretary of State Blinken visited the Middle East today and met with the Palestinian president, who called for an immediate ceasefire. CBS's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem.
It was Secretary Blinken's first trip to the West Bank since war between Israel and Hamas began almost a month ago. The U.S. State Department spokesman said Blinken told Abbas that Palestinians in Gaza must not be forcibly displaced. He said they also discussed the need to stop extremist violence against the Palestinians, referring to the rising number of attacks by Jewish settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank.
The U.S. is pushing for a humanitarian pause to get aid to desperate civilians. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on CNN's State of the Union.
We have got to stop the bombing now. You had over 600,000 people pushed out of their homes. Where are they going? They're staying in United Nations facilities, overcrowded. There's not enough water. There's not enough food. There's not enough medicine.
But Israel said it will press on with its offensive to completely destroy Hamas. The clock is ticking again for another potential government shutdown. Funding is set to run out November 17th. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson told Fox News Sunday he's optimistic.
I think you see a united and energized House Republican conference. All of our members are working together in good faith, trying to solve these great challenges that we face. And I'm very optimistic.
A possible Biden-Trump rematch in 2024 has Americans reacting. CBS News released a new poll today. Director of Elections and Surveys Anthony Salvanto told Face the Nation,
Donald Trump's voters are more apt to say they're hopeful and motivated about this idea of a possible rematch. Biden's voters, and a lot of voters, more apt to say that they're nervous, even frustrated about it.
According to the poll, President Biden trails Trump by 3 points. While thousands of people are still weaving through the streets of the Big Apple running the New York City Marathon right now, the elite runners have already crossed the finish line. For the men, the winner was Ethiopia's Tamarit Tola on ABC.
Here comes Tamarit Tola, and all that exhaustion will give way to elation as he wins the 52nd running of the
He finished a record 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 58 seconds. The women's marathon came down to a 3-person sprint, and Helen Obiri of Kenya was able to pull away from the pack, winning for the women. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
This is the story.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Teammate on that excursion to the North Pole was... it was mind-blowing. The fact, yeah, I mean, you know, to give the audience sort of just a general sense of it, you guys are carrying 300 pounds, 300 plus, 380 some odd pounds. You're pulling that sled up these chunks of ice. And, you know, on your first couple days in, you've only gone like, I don't know, 6 miles or something of hundreds of miles. And you got a tight deadline for a plane to come pick you up, or you're just stranded in the ocean forever. You know, no. I mean, it's really, I think, inspiring to see how far you push, I think, the human limits of, you know, what's possible inside yourself. And at the same time, showcasing how our planet is changing. So I very much so like applaud you for that. But, you know, I think let's kind of start at the beginning. Like, where did you grow up and what inspired you to go to the North Pole, to go to Everest, to go to all these crazy places? What inspired it?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I'm a huge fan. I've gone down the rabbit hole on your stuff quite a bit. And so I appreciate the opportunity. And it's fun to be able to have these types of conversations.
You are from Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah. I'm a proud Wisconsinite. I grew up just north of Milwaukee, Cedarburg. A pretty normal childhood. I love my hometown. I love going back.
It's gorgeous, man. Cedarburg, really. They got that river running through it. The nice downtown, man. It's like a low-key, very idyllic place to exist.
It's like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, basically. And, you know, our big line as kids was, and I don't know if this is still the case, but it was like the second biggest tourist attraction in Wisconsin, which is was our claim to fame that we wore pretty proudly on our... on our shirts. So
what's the first biggest tourist attraction in Wisconsin?
I mean, it must be Wisconsin Dells, I think.
You can't beat Wisconsin Dells.
No, it's, you can try, but you're still just the second biggest.
Yeah.
I don't know what the numbers on it. It speaks both highly and poorly of Wisconsin Dells, because I don't know what the numbers are on Wisconsin Dells to beat out Cedarburg. Is it a lot, or it doesn't seem like it would take much? You know what I mean?
You know,
it's like two more
Cedarburg's
people.
Really nice, man, you know, and they got the House on the Rock kind of in that area. I mean, you know, Rick Wilcox's Magic Castle, the Trojan Horse go-karts. I mean, it's no small feat to beat out Wisconsin Dells in this situation.
Yeah, well, we can always hope. I don't know. Maybe I'll get some of my friends to go visit and we'll just get the tally up to number one. Maybe that's a thing.
There you go. So you grew up in Cedarburg.
Yeah, I loved it. You know, I was a pretty average, probably about as average as you could get, like... just was like the slowest kid on my soccer team and, not terrible student, but, pretty average. Like no one would have looked at me and been like, oh yeah, that kid's going places. You know, they would have been like, oh, Eric, and then moved on to the next thing. So, but I think for me, I was always interested in being outside and I was trying to figure out the world around me. And I was curious and I loved camping. And so I was just trying to get out and do things. And back then, you know, there wasn't this big network of people. There wasn't a way to connect in any sort of real way. And so I just started doing things and I got interested in biking. And I got a paper out and saved up a bunch of money and bought a bicycle. And then I was gone. And that was like, I mean, I was 12 years old and I was with a map and just riding my bike for, you know, 60, 70, 100 miles over the weekend. And, you know, I would go into bars and Packers game would be on and I would get a Coke and then I would be in all my spandex, you know, and and that was in the 80s. And so people did not look well at that, you know, going to some of these just kind of random rural bars and, you know, a 12, 13 year old kid riding a road bike, you know, like Lance Armstrong wasn't a thing. And, but I loved it because I was on my own. I was out kind of just discovering the world around me. And I just started doing more of those things. Like I would just kind of always wrangle my friends into doing things. Like I'm like, let's canoe our river that runs through our town, Cedar Creek. But I'm like, I would get my mom to drive me up farther. And then we would like, I want to do more of it. So we would just like portage the canoe down Main Street, Cedarburg, so that we could keep going. And so I just was doing a lot of those things and was always really interested in being outside and just kind of discovering the world around me and in whatever way I could.
That's really cool. Biking was kind of the way I first got into outdoors as well. I was a bike mechanic in
high school. So yeah. Was I.
Oh, where at?
In Grafton, and I loved that job. It was Grafton Ski and Cyclery at the time. I worked there from the time I was 16 to my mid-20s, and I was a bike racer too eventually. But that job I credit with a lot of just problem-solving skills.
Yeah.
And you know everything. I mean, I spent a lot of time fixing bikes, but I did sales as well. But just, you know, getting these old jalopies in there and trying to figure out what was going on, and 3-speed hubs and blah blah blah. And there was no YouTube to look at. And
no,
so it was it was just figuring things out. But and that job also allowed me. I love bikes. I call myself the world's most boring person, because when I was a kid, I loved camping and bikes. And, you know, however many years later, I still love camping and bikes.
Yeah.
Where'd you work?
I was over at few places. I did Wheel and Sprocket, and I did Willie Bikes in Madison.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't, I'm going to say, the best mechanic in the world by any stretch. Arguably not great at all, but you know, I did my time there. No, I was okay. You know what I really like about just being a bike mechanic is, like, especially at an early age, it just gives you a general understanding of mechanics, even if you don't have that kind of a mind. You just have a little bit more that becomes intuitive. So this is the best part about being a bike mechanic, is you can start to Frankenstein your own bike, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I remember, I don't know what my dad was thinking, but thankfully he just didn't say much of anything, but I took his bike, and this was like, I started working in the late 80s. And so that, like, I have pictures of our bike shop, and it was all pink and yellow and, you know, fluorescent colors back then. And, we had this like cable housing that was fluorescent pink. And so I took my dad's bike and I, you know, put fluorescent pink cable housing and all the brakes and derailleurs, and then I wrapped his bars in like fluorescent yellow, and he was just like, okay. But it worked well, you know.
Yeah, that's a very bike mechanic thing to do, just totally, like, make it look like unnecessarily weird, you know.
Semi-flashy. And back then there was no real, like, the cool factor was just tacky, straight up tacky. So we didn't really have any sort of elegance or style. It was just like, oh, here's these like fluorescent colors, and let's put on our Oakley razor blades. And, you know, I mean, they made seat covers for a while that were just like these nylon things that were like leopard, like pink leopard skin seat covers.
I've seen those with the little, the zip up. You cinch them in the back.
Yeah. And then it just ended, you know. It was like that, the only way to quit that stuff is like cold turkey. You know, you can't go to rehab for that. You can't, you know, you just gotta and then it was done. And then we were in like forest green and maroon, you know.
Kurt Cobain was like the cold turkey of it all, you know. Grunge scene came around and then people were done with it.
Yeah.
Well, so you're a bike mechanic and you're in Wisconsin and you're doing your thing. You're exploring on the weekends, biking around. And do you just slowly get more and more aggressive with your explorations?
Yeah. I mean, it's a slow burn. You know, unfortunately, I don't have the exciting, like, I opened up a book or like someone stopped me on the street or whatever story. I got involved in a couple of groups that were doing trips. My family did a lot of camping as well. And then by the time I was in, high school, I started planning my own trips with friends. And so we did a trip down the Namekagon and St. Croix River. And then we started going up to the Boundary Waters. And, you know, at first it was like a week, and then it was a couple weeks, you know, and it was just amazing. I kind of think back on those times. I was just so green. I didn't know anything. We would get lost, turned around, you know, like whatever, get caught in storms, have accidents. And I loved every minute of it. I loved it. And I was also, I think another big Wisconsin thing, which I've heard you kind of mention, which I think is part of where this all comes from, is this idea of up north. You know, like everybody always talks about going up north. And so I was always really interested in going farther north and just kind of that transition into more wilderness. I always loved it. And going up to northern Wisconsin and just being in more wild areas. And as a result, I was obsessed with Alaska too. And which was, you know, the kind of the last frontier of wilderness. And I also read a lot of books. I read a lot of expedition books, exploration, adventure books. So I had all these things in my mind. But when I graduated college, I got a job in Alaska as a backcountry ranger. And then my world just opened up because I was like, oh, this is what a mountain is. You know, I had never really seen a mountain before. I hadn't been out of the Midwest. You know, I had been nowhere. And then I was just like, man, this is amazing. And I, you know, was howled at wolves and had close encounters with grizzly bears and glaciers. And I was just like, man, how can I get more of this stuff? And I realized there that if you were willing to accept, you know, uncertainty, like if you didn't have a straight path and you weren't necessarily worried about making money, there are a lot of opportunities that exist out there, and all you got to be willing to do is take them. And so that was kind of the path that I was on after that. And, you know, it wasn't like just going up. There was a lot of setbacks. You know, I was making no money so much of the time. And, you know, it was back then, there was no such thing as a tiny home. I was living in a shack, and, you know, it wasn't a status symbol, or living out of your car wasn't like van life. It was just like, you suck, you know? So it was challenging, but that was kind of the trajectory. And I eventually got into, I wanted to be somewhere where there was more winter. And so I moved to Grand Marais, Minnesota. A neighbor from my hometown was building a cabin. So I went up just as a odd job and doing some carpentry work. And I just happened to stumble into this job at this resort as a dog musher. And, you know, then I was like, man, all the things kind of clicked together. I was like, I'd never even seen a sled dog.
Yeah.
And it was crazy.
So you were in Alaska at this point, and you went to Minnesota for more winter. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I came back. Well, it was, you know, it's hard because you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, I had gone up to Alaska, and that was my kind of first big experience, you know, out on my own after college. And I had planned on staying up there, but I wanted to come back and see some friends and, you know, do all the things that I thought I was missing. And I ended up getting stuck in Wisconsin with no car and whatever. So I didn't get back to Alaska. And so, you know, there's always a little kind of roadblocks in the way. And eventually I would end up in northern Minnesota. Yeah. So I don't have too many regrets, because all the bad things get you to the good places as well. But I always think, man, I could have ended up in Alaska, and I've been back many times and whatnot, but it's every time I go, I'm like, oh man, this place is awesome.
Yeah. I love how, you know, you're always kind of have been, you were always obsessed with up north, and you got to the most up north place you could get to on Earth.
Yes, you know? That's true.
The North Pole.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for let's dive into that. So this was it Discovery that put out this that you shot this for?
Yeah, it was. Well, so I've done a bunch of North Pole expeditions. I did one in 2006, which was the first ever summer North Pole expedition. I did another one in 2010 as well. But the North Pole for me has always been just this unique environment that's so unlike any other place on the planet. It's just, you're traveling across an ocean that's covered with a thin layer of ice. It's brutally difficult. And so a big part of my mission is kind of telling stories of places and connecting to people to these places that are so, you know, distant and kind of out of mind of people. And so I really wanted to film and share the story of an expedition to the North Pole. And that was kind of the trajectory that I was working on. And I just got lucky. I got a call from Animal Planet at the time, which is a Discovery Network. And they're like, mm-hmm. Hey, what are you doing that would make a good movie? And I'm like, have I got the story for you, you know? And so they're like, well, here's like a very tiny chunk of change. Go film it. And if you come out alive, we'll see if we can make a movie out of it. And so they didn't want to take the risk of any sort of bigger commitment, because they're like, well, we don't know what's going to happen. And I'm like, well, that's the beauty of it. You know, mm-hmm. that's what a real adventure is. There's an uncertain outcome. We had kind of set some big goals and also we're filming it. And for me, that was really the most important, was to be able to tell a story of that place through our journey, which is kind of that personal connection, to really help people better understand what it was like. So, and it turned out well. I mean, I think the narration is a little over the top, but I think the story, it's not fake reality, you know, like we weren't up there staging anything. We were filming it all ourselves. It's a challenging environment just sitting there, let alone trying to do all that other junk. And so, yeah, I'm proud of that. And it was many years ago now, but it's still something that I look at as one of my biggest accomplishments, I would say, or bigger accomplishments for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there were a few things that stuck out to me as just, wow, this is an incredible landscape. And you guys are mind blowing the risk that you take. You know, you're standing on that rubbery ice, you know, yes. and this is ice that connects two different ice chunks of the North Pole. And, you know, you're basically, if the ice cracks, then the salt deteriorates the ice, you know, but you're basically on these skis on this rubbery thing. And then you actually swim, you get in the water in a dry suit and you swim, I don't know, 100 yards to the next thing. And you get out and you pull your other buddy, over. I mean, polar bears, you know, like you had polar bears tracking you a few times in the thing. I mean, these are some really intense environmental I don't know, it's so wild, because I've done a little bit of sort of the backpacking and all that. I did the Appalachian Trail, I did the Bighorn Mountains, and even just being maybe 10, 20 miles out in the wilderness, when you're climbing up, we were climbing up a waterfall, I was climbing up with my buddy, I was like, man, one slipped rock,
oh yeah,
I'm done, you know.
Yeah,
but
totally.
Maybe, you know, a helicopter could come, probably. Where you are, no. I mean, if you get hypothermia, you're dead within, you know, an hour or something. I don't know. It's just insane the kind of risk that you guys were taking. Do you just get to that gradually over time, or do you have something that's always been inside you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, risk, I think, is relative to your knowledge, experience, and preparation. So
you're saying I'm an idiot, is what you're saying. Which I appreciate. I am. You figured that out.
I don't necessarily like to call people out right away without knowing that well, but if that's what it comes to, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
No, you're not an idiot. You're just inexperienced. No, I'm just kidding.
No, that's also true. That's also very true.
I mean, where, you know, there's the classic line, it's like, where does good judgment come from? And it's bad judgment, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a level of risk in being in those situations and being so far removed from any sort of, you know, rescue. That being said, it's calculated, and it's also, you know, a function of our experience, our training, you know, our ability to deal with uncertainty and kind of unknowns as they come up. And I do feel you get better at that, both physically from like, oh, I can do this and fix this, to philosophically, which is just kind of like taking a mental hand and pushing down all that fear and anxiety to be able to go. And so you know, my first North Pole expedition, I was skiing on the ice and I was just crying the whole time because I was so scared. And slowly you just start getting better at it. And, you know, and it's not like I just went to that North Pole for the first time. I mean, I was doing all sorts of camping trips. I was going to the Boundary Waters. I was backpacking. I was riding my bike. I mean, all this stuff. And so it's this process of getting there. And that, and I would say the risk for my types of expeditions are, you know, a little less than, you know, say someone on the side of the mountain with no rope. You know, they sneeze and they fall 1,000 feet. I fall like, you know, a couple feet and then I brush the snow off the ground and keep going on. But
right.
It's an interesting process overall, for sure.
From Liney Lodge and Carson Park, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown and all of Wisconsin. 93.5, The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Israel has cut internet and phone lines in the Gaza Strip for the third time since the start of the war. Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer told Face the Nation.
The devastating toll that this has taken on civilians is one that deeply concerns us, one that we raise in a very direct way, both publicly, as Secretary Blinken has done, as others have done, and privately and directly with the government of Israel.
Americans are speaking out in a new CBS News poll. Deputy Director of Surveys Jennifer DePinto.
73% of Americans say things in the country are going badly, a high for the year. And in a potential 2024 matchup with Donald Trump, Biden trails by 3 points.
The elite runners have crossed the finish line at the New York City Marathon on ABC.
From the bridge, through the burrows, to the breaking of the tape, Helen O'Beary is the champ.
The men's winner was Ethiopia's Tamarit Tola. CBS News Brief. I'm Stacy Lynn.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks head to Brooklyn. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks head east to play the Brooklyn Nets tomorrow night. Tip-off time at 6:30. Then they're back home in Milwaukee Wednesday night against the Detroit Pistons. That one starts at 7 o'clock. The Bucks with a 110-105 win over the Knicks Friday night. Milwaukee head coach Adrian Griffin, looking for ways to improve their defense and rebounds, moved Brooke Lopez back, but says it wasn't his idea.
I didn't have to say anything. He approached me, and it just speaks to his character, and, you know, he's a winner.
College football, the Badgers lost on the road at Indiana for the first time since 2002. The final, Indiana 20, Wisconsin 14. Head coach Luke Fickell on losing the turnover battle.
You know, they either out-hustled us or just, you know, we got to make our own breaks. You know, sometimes as you look back at it, that might be the difference in the ballgame. The ability to capitalize on the opportunities that you have and the ability to create some turnovers is, you know, is something that we didn't have a chance to do.
That's Wisconsin head coach Luke Fickell. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your hometown radio refreshed. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mostly cloudy sky, a light south to southeast wind up to 15. Could see some mid to late afternoon sprinkles moving in, otherwise 53 degrees. For your Sunday night, sprinkles and some light rain around, steady temperatures in the lower 50s and staying breezy. Right now it's 51.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
OptUS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap. Local talk about our hometown and all of Wisconsin has gone untapped until now. You're on 93.5 The Tap. Make sure and tell your friends.
Folks, if you're just tuning in now, I am talking with fellow Wisconsinite and polar explorer, Eric Larson. You've been to the North Pole, as you said, over the past, first time was in 06, or when was your first time to the North
Pole? Yeah, 06, yeah.
Since 06, and since going back, what are the changes that you've seen in the North Pole, specifically as it relates to climate change?
Yeah, I mean, the nature and character of the ice is dramatically different. So the first thing is, and if you read back to some of the historical expeditions from the 1800s, 1900s, and even in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you see that these people would go across a big, huge sheet of ice, and it would just be huge and miles across. And then they would come to kind of one of those transition zones where those two pans or sheets of ice would collide up against each other. And then there'd be huge blocks of ice. It's called a pressure ridge. And then you get over it and be in another big sheet of ice. And we saw that a lot in 2006 as well. We would ski for miles across these big pans. And over time, the ice has become thinner. And so what you see now is that ice, as it moves around, it breaks up more and becomes more fractured and pressured. And so you don't see these big extents of ice anymore. You see less big flat areas and more just continual rough patches. You also see, you know, again, we don't see this as much, but just kind of from satellite data, as I look and plan trips, like where the overall extent of the ice is definitely shrinking. And then you just look at weather patterns. I mean, there's kind of a mentor hero of mine who went to the North Pole in 1986. It was minus 80 at the start of their trip.
Wow.
They wore the soles of their boots off in the first couple of days because the snow was so dry. It was like sandpaper. And, you know, now you might see, it's variable, you know, weather is variable and climate is more the general pattern, but, you know, maybe minus 50 or minus 40, minus 30. So just the overall kind of temperature changes. So there's dramatic changes that are happening, very significantly for sure.
And as you kind of, you know, I think the question is, like, when you go to the North Pole the way that you did, and you made it, you know, as several times in this show, and you've done other things too, but I'm just kind of focusing on the North Pole right now. When you go to a place like that, or I guess we'll throw in, you know, Everest or Antarctica, you go to these places, what is your purpose in doing it? Is it to just go farther than you could ever go before? Is it to kind of take something from that and show it to the rest of the world? And if it's the latter, what is it you're hoping to show to the rest of the world?
That's a good question. And it's evolved over time. I think for me, overall, you know, my background is in environmental science. So I was always very focused in environmental education. So that was kind of a big part of my life. And I got into adventure. I always wanted to do expeditions, but I wasn't like, hey, what's got two thumbs and is totally awesome. You know, I wasn't trying to make it be the Eric show. I was just trying to get people interested in these places. And, you know, I had taken a global climate change class when I was in college in the early 90s, and they were talking about the same science in 1992 that we're talking about today or whatever. And what I stumbled on through, you know, either being a guide or, you know, a straight up educator, was that adventure was a really powerful hook to get people interested in these places and these issues. It doesn't matter what your political background is. It doesn't matter what your ideologies are. You can be interested in adventure, and then we can kind of talk about some of these bigger environmental issues. And so that's always been my personal platform and objective. And it's changed over time as the economy changes and people's, you know, philosophies changes, and, you know, the science necessarily hasn't changed, but the acceptance of science. And so, you know, initially it was just like, hey, let's just get people to believe that global warming exists. We'll take a canoe up to the North Pole, mm-hmm. and we'll show people just that image. And that was like our goal, you know? And then, you know, it spanned to more, you know, kind of political initiatives and things like that. And honestly, even now, just simply, which is maybe less important, but also more important, is just getting people excited about winter and the role that, you know, cold weather plays in our life. Because a lot of times people talk about global warming, they're like, oh yeah, great, I hate winter anyways, you know. But what often is misconstrued with that is that, you know, cold weather, the polar ice caps, those are parts of a healthy planet, and that helps regulate global temperatures. My kind of focus has evolved. And simultaneously, I do like this kind of personal push of trying to do difficult things and the challenge of that. It's like fixing a bike, you know. It's like, how do you put all these pieces together so that you can kind of move forward through this environment and achieve this really difficult objective that most people said you couldn't do?
What do you think nature has and wilderness has and gives people? Why do you think it's important?
Oh man, it's a great question. It's a great question, because I wouldn't call myself an old curmudgeon by any stretch, but I feel a little reactive at times. And so I spend a lot of my time, I train a lot on my bike. So I spend a lot of time on my own just thinking. And I'll come across, like, or if I'm hiking, there'll be someone with like a speaker on their backpack, you know, and they'll be hiking in the woods and that music will be blaring and I'll be having this quiet moment. And so that always gets me thinking, like, well, what's the value of silence? Like, part of nature is being quiet. You know, we live in a world now where we have, you know, 24/7 stimuli and electronics. And so just having that time where there isn't any of that is important. You know, and the list goes on from there. It's like, discovering things, whether it's a plant or a scene or a place. I think nature has, presents the opportunity to make mistakes. You know, that's another thing today. We're so afraid to try things because we don't want to look like idiots. And, you know, we were talking about this with kind of risk earlier, but I made so many mistakes on some of my early adventures, and still to this day, I do, you know, where we come up short or get lost or who knows, take the wrong gear. And, you know, there's, I think a really important part of nature allows you to be able to do those things without any sort of like criticism or whatever. And so I think the list goes on and on in terms of like the value of nature, and we're animals, you know, like we're connected to nature. Like that's part of who we are. And I don't know about you, but man, I'm busy. I'm on the computer all the time and I get out and all of a sudden I'm like, I just feel better. You know, I feel more relaxed and my mind clears up. I'm happy. You know,
it's almost like, as we've seen in society, and I'm no doctor or anything, so if anyone's like, oh, what the hell is he talking about? But this is my opinion, is that we're all on our phones. The more we're on our phones, the more, what do we see now? Anxiety, depression, suicide, right? Rising. Why? Because we're like living here, and this is a miserable, miserable place to live. And but out there, you know, there are several studies that say just being in nature calms your anxiety. That idea of being bored, boredom is where creativity comes from. And even on another level, you look at all the diseases that have been solved and cured based on things that they find in the rainforest, for example. It's like everything is there, but, you know, yet we destroy it to make more of these screens, you know, which I'm looking at you on a screen. So I'm part of this too, and, you know, and, I'm part
and
of the deal.
Both of our lives are focused on that. How do you balance your time? Because you're living in a very digital world as well. I'm very curious about that because it's something that I wrestle with as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm very lucky to have a great team. One of my team members is looking at me right now that luckily do a lot of the technology aspect of it. I mean, I started off doing all of that and then got to a pretty good breaking point on that. And then, over time, you know, I still do a lot of it. But you know, it's just nice to, it's nice to have a team to sort of share in that and very help. I couldn't do it without the team is really what it comes down to. But for me personally, the time I personally...
By the way, that sounded like a hostage statement, what you just
you should
said.
You should see the way she's looking at me. You're right like,
she's you like, got to hold up a newspaper so I know that it's actually today. I need
I do very much so mean it. I do very much so mean it. I just can't... If you look at Colleen right now, and it, you know, for people who listen to the podcast a lot, they know that Colleen and I have a... very interesting dynamic in the intros where she gives me hell all the time. So she keeps looking at me and giving me a weird look, and it's making me self-conscious. But the truth of the matter is I really do. I couldn't do without them, and I think they do great.
Of course.
But yeah, there's really something nice about turning it off and just going outside.
Well, I have kids, and which is the most amazing thing for me. But I grew up in a time, my buddies and I talk about this all the time. We're like, how lucky were we that nobody had phones and nobody was recording any of the stupid stuff that we did, because we would not be, you know, I would not be living a free life probably. Who knows? but I think the other part of that is, you know, we did things, and me especially, I did things because I was interested in them. So I, you know, wanted to ride my bike, so I just started riding my bike. I wanted to do this trip, so I just started to do, you know, this camping trip. And that was the extent of it. And so I think about my kids, and, you know, we do a ton of outside stuff. We can't, my son is a hardcore skier and he's 11. I mean, he's a way better skier than me. I always tell him, like, dude, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I was skiing in jeans at Little Switzerland, you know, like, you have all the best gear and you're on a 12,000 foot mountain, you know, right. There's
Step
just no,
off.
Yeah. And he's like, come on, dad. And I'm like, and I'm literally scared looking at the stuff that he's like basically going backwards down.
Oh my God.
But anyway, so I think about it with my kids because there is a balance. I mean, like, I love technology. There's a lot of good aspects of technology. And you see that them get sucked into it pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And so I do really, but I do believe in that connection to nature for an individual level, but also in terms of, you know, kind of a global health environmental level as well.
No, I do think, and also I thought this is where you were going with that, but back in like when you were growing up, when there was no social media, you did stuff because you wanted to do stuff. You didn't necessarily do stuff because you wanted a picture of you doing stuff. And I think that changes how we interact with, things. And sometimes if we sort of scrape the surface of an experience to sort of get a picture to put it out there, as opposed to really doing it because you genuinely want to do it. I mean, maybe there's a difference in that as well.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to be negative about it, but there's kind of this hyper reality that exists, where you're just creating these situations just for the image, and you're not really diving in. And so much of life happens below the surface, you know, and that's part of the reason why I do these long expeditions. Like, how do you get to know a place? Like, you can kind of get to know it by driving across and looking out the window and whatever. And on a bike, you're a little slower. Hiking, you're even slower, and you kind of understand what this hill is. But when you're in a place for, you know, a week or a month or 2 months, like, you really begin to understand the nuance of what that area is like. And And I think that kind of permeates into all life. There's just, it's not right or wrong, left or right. There's so much more nuance and everything. And so we're just not getting it. And I will say, I don't mean to blow sunshine up you, but that's where I was sick for a couple of years, and I was looking at some of this stuff and it was just brutal. And that's when I think I started stumbling on some of your stuff, and I just found it really funny and engaging, because it wasn't like, hey, I'm trying to be this certain thing. I'm just having a good time and, you know, kind of pointing out some quirks of our place or whatever. And so I really enjoyed that, actually.
Oh, thank you.
It was refreshing for me.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm glad I could entertain you a bit with that, you know. It's nice when you come from that place and you see those things. And I sort of stumbled upon that, you know. I didn't realize people would take to it the way they did. So I got lucky in that regard. It's that sense of home, you know.
Totally.
What is the craziest thing you've ever encountered out there in the wild?
Crazy is a relative term.
Okay,
you know?
What's the closest you've come to a near death situation? Let's start.
Oh,
with
I mean, I've had polar bears jump on my tent while I'm sleeping in them.
Really?
Oh yeah. You know, polar bears, you can't think about any of these things. Like, you get kind of a little gallows humor going on. You're like, oh, that was close. Because if you stop and like really be like, oh man, then you start getting pretty nervous. But there was a time where this was off the coast of Russia, and we were just in this crazy situation. It was all open water. Wherever there was open water, there were seals. Polar bears eat seals. So there's lots of polar bears around. And what they do is they jump on kind of these ice chunks when the seals are having the babies, and they smash, because the seals have their babies underneath, and they smash the seals under there and then they eat them. And so this polar bear like basically did that to the front of our tent, you know, the vestibule, the part that we're not necessarily sleeping in. But so the whole tent kind of caved down on us. And, you know, I woke up and was somewhat alarmed. And
Wow.
But I've had, a lot of polar bears encounters. I've had a lot of black bear encounters over the years. I've been chased by a moose, avalanches on Everest. It's just like the more you're out, the more stuff that happens. But I will say I'm a pretty careful guy. I'm not the guy jumping off the cliff and being like, woo-hoo, you know, like,
yeah, right.
I'm a slow chess game guy. I mean, I don't know if that's because I'm from Wisconsin or if it's just the nature of my personality.
It's a very Midwest of you. Very Midwest.
Oh yeah. 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 It's,
well,
I have to explain
this cautious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to explain it to my wife all the time, because she's from the East Coast and she's like so straightforward and, you know, doesn't, you know, always tells it like it is. I'm like, you could sugarcoat it a little bit, you know, like doesn't hurt to say one nice thing, you know? So I'm like, you gotta, and we'll go back to the Midwest and we'll go into the gas station and she'll be like, why was that person being so nice to me? I'm like, that's just how they are, you know? She doesn't get it.
that does take a while, especially from the East Coast. There's a little bit of a learning curve there.
Yeah. She's just like, am I, you know, what's going on here? And I'm like, no, just get used to it. It's going to happen everywhere.
We're almost at time here, but I wanted to ask, you know, sort of your advice for people who are, you know, maybe like the outdoors and they're looking to kind of start their first adventure. Maybe it's a solo hiking trip. Maybe it's going to a mountain they've never gone to before. What would be, you know, your top tips for kind of a new experience and one you're unfamiliar with?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, Wisconsin's a great place to start. Anywhere is, really, but there's so many cool areas all over Wisconsin. But my big tip is just to get out and do something, anything. Don't let the idea of it like impede your ability to just go out and try. And ultimately just starting small. Like I've seen so many people want to do these big trips for the first, you know, it's their first time out. And then they just get into that first hour and it's just overwhelming. Their pack's too heavy. They got the wrong gear, whatever it is. And so I think, you know, a great thing is just starting small, you know, go on a little hike, go on an overnight, you know, not even a long overnight. We do this with our kids a lot. We'll just go drive up the afternoon. We'll hike 3 miles up a mountain, set up camp and come back. It's like 23 hour thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's not this big consequence. So I'm a huge fan of just, and we'll even just set up our tent in our backyard and sleep out there. Like I got my kids winter camping when they were just like 2 years old and we just were in the backyard, you know? That's and, cool. So I think that's a big thing. And then there's, you know, now there's a lot of stuff online, obviously, even though we were just dissing online, there are a lot of great resources and there are also a lot of groups, where you know, you can go out and learn from other people for, you know, this didn't really exist when I was in school, but I know just if anybody's in college or university or even high schools, I think have some pretty awesome outdoor programs and getting involved there and, you know, doing whatever. But ultimately for me, my biggest advice, just get outside, just go do something and keep going.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you and follow you?
They can find me in my tent somewhere cold, probably, because that's where I like to be. Yeah. If you Google I hate my website URL, but it's old and I'm redoing it. It's from like 1980, but ericlarsonexplorer.com. But I do the whole Instagram or social EL Explorer. You can just Google Eric Larson, Wisconsin.
Awesome.
My name comes up.
Perfect, man. Well, hey, yeah. Thank you so much. And is that, I should have asked this before I asked that last one, but is there anything you think I should have asked about that I didn't, or any final thoughts that you have?
I was surprised to, because I, like I said, I went down the rabbit hole. So I was really interested. I was glad that we got to talk a lot about the environmental stuff, because that doesn't necessarily happen. And I thought the other topics would have been like Midwest beauty queens.
Yeah.
that was like, how am I following this lady on Instagram, this Alex Worley? And I was like, why is this lady keep popping up?
Oh yeah.
And then I found out that you had a connection to her, which
yes, I did.
Which we don't need to get into now, but I was very, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, I got lost. And then we touched on Mr. B. So I will say, I do this, if you're ever interested, I got this great polar training course up in northern Minnesota. It's awesome. Yeah. If you want to come, I'll send you the information.
Please do.
You that just come with, cool. It's in January. Okay. I would love to have you and just expose you to some of that stuff. And it's a good resource for other adventures, like kind of the style of stuff that we're doing really applies to any sort of other adventure. But I appreciate the opportunity to kind of talk I was psyched, because as I went down the rabbit hole, I was like, oh man, this guy's pretty interesting and got some similar interests. So I was psyched.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We do have similar interests and I've become very rapidly a big fan of yours. So congrats on everything that you've accomplished and will continue to accomplish. And love the environmental stuff too, man. It was awesome to talk to you. And I send me that. I would love to check that out, that polar thing. All right.
Cool,
man. Thanks again. Yeah, thank you. We'll talk
soon. Have a great day and eat some cheese for me, please.
Yeah, I will. All right. Right back at you now.
All right.
See ya. That is it for this week, folks. Special thanks to Eric for coming on the show to talk about his expeditions and his travels. And I might just have to go do that polar excursion class he was telling me about. I got to find the time.
Yeah.
But I would love to do that. And if you guys want to do that with Eric, just give him a follow at EL Explorer and on Facebook, Polar Explorer Eric Larson. Check out his book also, On Thin Ice, An Epic Final Quest into the Melting Arctic. And check out his videos and clips and his adventures, everything at ericlarsonexplore.com. Finally, folks, you can...
On air, 93.5 FM. Online, thetap.com. And on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
93.5, The Tap. This is 93.5, The Tap. It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5, The Tap.